Let's see. Okay, great. So welcome everybody back. It's nice to see you all over the screen. Hope you all had a wonderful Pesach, or as enjoyable as it could be under the circumstances. It was definitely a memorable one for me, a interesting, unique experience. And again, hope everybody is healthy and well. I want to wish you all a happy Yom Ha'atzma'ut as well. And hopefully we'll try to connect what we're going to talk about today to Yom Ha'atzma'ut, to Israeli Independence Day. But I want to first introduce the topic that we'll be learning about over these next few weeks in preparation for Shavuos. So Shavuos, as we know, is the holiday that we'll be celebrating in a few weeks. And on it, we celebrate the day when the Jews received the Torah, Kabbalas HaTorah, when we received the Torah. And so, sorry, just before we continue, I'm just going to mute everybody. And if anybody has any questions, if we could just wait till the end of this year for questions. Okay, so on Shavuos we celebrate the receiving of the Torah, but it was actually something a little bit more than that. Something that we celebrate on Shavuos is also the time when the Jewish people changed from being Bnei Yisrael, the children of Israel, to becoming Am Yisrael, the nation of Israel. And what that means is that up until that point, then when the Jewish people had left Egypt, we were a bunch of tribes. We were a bunch of Shevatim. We were a bunch of tribes, descendants of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and Hashem had redeemed us. But we hadn't fully become a nation until we received the Torah. As we spoke about before Pesach, the Torah is the Koach HaMe'ached, the nexus and origin point of Jewish identity. And when Moshe Rabbeinu was preparing the Jewish people to receive the Torah, he said over the words of Hashem that if you accept the Torah, you will become Mamleches Kohanim V'goy Kadosh, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, those are two separate things. Mamleches Kohanim is a reference to politics, polity, national institutions. So you will have a national institution or a polity or a government of priests. Now, it doesn't literally mean Kohanim, because only during the Hasmonean period did we have Kohanim as kings, but it means you will have essentially a holy political system. Goy Kadosh refers to a culture or a national character. So the Jewish nation, upon acceptance of the Torah, became a Jewish people, became a unified nation with both a holy, sanctified political infrastructure, a holy polity, as well as a holy national identity, a national character, and a national culture. That's what happened on Shavuos. That's what we commemorate on Shavuos. That is what the Torah gave the Jewish people. And that process was essentially a conversion process. Up until that point, we hadn't really become a nation. We had become a bunch of people that God had chosen to redeem. But we hadn't really become the Jewish people yet. And we essentially converted on Shavuos. A lot of the preparations for receiving the Torah is actually the source for what we learn about, for what we do to people that want to convert to Judaism nowadays. A lot of it is modeled after the process of receiving the Torah by Sinai. And so, as preparation for Shavuos, what I'd like to talk about over the next few weeks and learn with you all is what that means. What is the Jewish identity? What does it mean to become part of the Jewish people, to rejoin the Jewish people, to be part of the Jewish people? And I want to look at it through a number of lenses. One lens is the halachic, the legal lens. Another is the theological, the hashkafic lens. But also, I want to talk about it from the perspective of both history and science. And so this week we'll try to do a little bit of most of those. The topic, I don't know if you will receive the source sheets. I'll share it with you. Let me see if I can do that. Hold on. Okay, yeah. So the topic that I want to learn with you all about today was something that happened over the last, I would say, 200 years. In reality, it was a debate that was going on for many centuries before that, but it really came to the forefront in the last 200 years, and then with the founding of the State of Israel really became an international issue. And that is the status of a group of Jews or self-identified Jews from India, known as the B'nai Israel. As I'm sure you all know, over the last 72 years with the founding of the State of Israel and the Law of Return, there have been a number of groups of people that trace their historical roots to the ancient Jewish people. But through the ravages of history, they really lost contact with mainstream Judaism, and a lot of their, they didn't have much contact, and a lot of their practices were not in consonance with traditional Orthodox Judaism. And it was only when they regained connection to the rest of the Jewish community and they wanted to integrate back into it that this debate surfaced as to, are these people Jewish? If they are Jewish, can they rejoin the community? And each group, whether it be the B'nai Israel, the Beta Israel, the Ethiopian Jews, there's a lot, there were many, many different cases, and each one was different and unique, with various different answers. The one I want to talk about with you today is the B'nai Israel. So if you look on the map at the beginning of the beginning of the source sheet, it should be on the screen. It's a map of India. There were three sort of main areas where the Jewish people lived in India throughout the last, I would say, 1,000 to 2,000 years. Now, India is unique among countries where Jews lived because, with very, very few exceptions, there are almost no instances of anti-Semitism for Jews in India. We have historical records of Jews living in India at least since around the year 1000, and their personal histories go back to King Shlomo, to King Solomon, or at least to the destruction of the first temple. There have been almost no instances of anti-Semitism, and the ones that happened were perpetrated by people that were not from India. So I guess one of the earlier ones were when the Portuguese people set up a colony in India. So it was during the Inquisition, so Jews were persecuted then. And then much more recently, the Mumbai massacres with the Chabad house there. But again, most of those people were not native Indians. So the Jewish community, it was small, but they really flourished for thousands of years in relative peace. And if you can look on the map, there were three primary areas where the Jews lived. The oldest ones were in the bottom of India, the bottom of the subcontinent, called the Cochin Jews. They lived in the near Calicut, which is on the southwestern tip of the subcontinent. Most of their personal history traces back to King Shlomo HaMelech, where they arrived as traders, and then the community grew after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. We have historical references to this community, I think starting from the 1000s or the 1100s, if I'm not mistaken, by Jewish merchants and travelers. And then the community really grew after the Spanish Inquisition, when Spanish Jewish refugees came to India, and the community continued to grow. They built shuls, they built yeshivos, and the community really flourished. And then with the founding of the State of Israel, they pretty much moved to Israel. I believe in the Israel Museum, they have a shul that was built by the Cochin Jews that they transported there. So if you want to take a look the next time you go to Israel, you can see it there. So that was probably the oldest community. The most recent community was in Calcutta, If you look on the eastern part of India, near Bangladesh, so that was where the Baghdadi Jews sort of set up trading posts. It was a mating trade. It was a very major trading area, and a lot of Baghdadi Jews moved there for trading, and they set up a very, very vibrant community. And that was much more recent. I would say that was probably starting in the 1700s, and it continues to this day. They actually still have Iraqi shuls open in Calcutta. The third one, the third Jewish community, which we'll talk about, which is the main focus of today's shiur, were the B'nai Israel that lived in the Mumbai, the Bombay area. That's on the northwestern or the central western part of the Indian subcontinent. And if you look in source number one, I got this from the diaspora, the Jewish Diaspora Museum. It's on their website. This was a sort of a summary written by Dr. Shalva Weil about the B'nai Israel. I'll just summarize it for you. According to their tradition, the ancestors of this B'nai Israel community fled Israel during the time of the persecution of Antiochus. They were shipwrecked on a village around 175 BCE with only seven men who were Kohanim and seven women. Now, it's just, I'll ask you all to remember these facts for the end of the shiur because this will become somewhat important. So they claim that there were seven men and seven women. And these were the, and these survivors founded the Jewish community in India. These B'nai Israel were known by the Indian locals as the I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but they were called the Shanwar Telis, which is Indian for Saturday oil men, because their businesses were closed on Shabbos. This community was very isolated until a Cochin Jew arrived from the south by the name of David Rahabi. David Rahabi was probably, we don't know, it depends when it happened. They claimed it happened around 1000 CE, current historians dated to be much more recent in the 1700s. Nobody knows, but he was a Cochin Jew, either from the Spanish refugees or just one of the indigenous Cochin Jews. He was traveling north and he met these people. And the he asked the women to prepare him some fish to eat because fish don't need to be shechted. He didn't know if these people were Jewish. But these women picked out fish that were kosher. They separated the kosher fish from the non-kosher fish and prepared it for him to eat. And this was proof to David Rahabi that these people were Jewish. And they asked him to teach, them about Judaism, and he agreed. Now, these people really did not have much of a Jewish background. The only two things that they did up until that point was that they did bris milah, they circumcised the male children on the eighth day, and they kept Shabbos. Those were the only two things. They did not have any Torahs, they did not have any Gemaras, they did not have any Halacha. That was really all that they knew. They claimed to be Jewish, they kept Shabbos, and they kept bris milah. David Rahabi began to teach them more about Torah and mitzvos. If you look further, he taught them about Shavuos and Sukkos. He taught them about Tisha B'Av. It's interesting. He taught them about a holiday called Ramzan, which is a fast that is held throughout the month of Elul when Jews do tshuva before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So Sephardic Jews have the custom of saying Slichos the entire month of Elul. Apparently, the Cochin custom was to fast on those days. And indeed, even to this day, there is a minhag, there is a custom for some people to fast on days that you say Slichos. So this could be a reference to that custom. I taught them about Tzom Gedalia, about Tu B'Shvat, Shivasar B'Tamuz, you know, different basic tenets of Jewish life. In the 1800s, something happened to the B'nai Israel community. Just if you see that they, you see these two pictures. The first one is a B'nai Israel father and son that are in a house. And the picture below that is a Haggadah written in, I believe, Sanskrit and Hebrew. This was a B'nai Israel Haggadah. And this was sort of brought about by Christian missionaries who built schools for the Jewish community. They translated these Siddurim into their local language, and then they began to essentially learn English and Hebrew and Indian. They began to become much more literate, both in terms of worldly culture and just general worldliness, as well as their knowledge about Judaism. Both of those factors were very instrumental when in the 19th century, in the 1800s, they began to move from much more rural communities to much more urban to city communities and take up city professions. This was significant because when, just like any other Jewish person, when they're looking for a when they're looking for a community to move into, they want, many of them want to move into a community with other Jews. And that's exactly what these B'nai Israel people wanted to do. So when they decided to move into the cities, they moved, many of them moved to the Baghdadi community on the eastern side of India. And as we'll see, they became very, very integrated into the Iraqi community. They were accepted, they joined the shuls, they joined the schools, and they were really welcomed with open arms because they had accepted what normative Sephardic halachic Judaism. David Rahavi was the pioneer of that. And from that point onward, they began to learn and accept mainstream normative Judaism. After a number of years, a question arose. Now that they were fully integrated into the Jewish community, these B'nai Israel people had children who had reached marriageable age. And many of them wanted to marry the Iraqi community members, and vice versa. The Iraqis wanted to marry these B'nai Israel, but they weren't sure if they were allowed to do that. Now, if it were me, I would say that their concern was, are these people Jewish or not? Here we met these people in a very isolated community. They didn't really have normative Jewish practice. They just claimed to be Jewish. So I would have thought that their question was, are these people Jewish? But as we'll see, that was not their question at all. It was far more nuanced than that. Up until this point, no one had doubted their claims of Judaism. Ironically, the fact that no one doubted it actually made it more complicated for them to integrate into the Jewish community. As you see in source number 2 from a letter that the Rambam wrote to the sages of Lunel in the Provence region of France, the Rambam accepted them as Jews too. If you look, this is a letter that he wrote. In source number 2, he says, Aval ha-Yehudim behodu einan yodim ha-Torah shebichsav. There are these Jews in India that don't even know the written Torah. Ve'ein lahen min hadas, they don't have any Jewish religion. Ela shein shovsin v'nimolin l'shmona. They keep Shabbos and they circumcise their children on the 8th day. So the Rambam, even the Rambam himself, hundreds of years before this question arose, acknowledged that they were Jewish. And that actually made the question much more complicated. So if you look at source number 3, this is a letter from the Iraqi community in Calcutta to the Iraqi Talmidei Chachamim, to the Iraqi sages both in Baghdad and in Yerushalayim. The letter was sent in the year 1843. So I'll read to you the letter. It says, Zeh hayom kama shanim sheba lemachanenu min Bombay ish v'ishto ubanav me hayehudim hayudim bimekomotam b'nei Yisrael. So on this day for many years, a family has come into our camp from Bombay, a man, his wife, and sons from the Jewish community known in their place as the B'nai Israel. And this man, this head of the family, mehayom she yedanuhu, from the day that we knew him ad hayom hazeh, until this day, hu ubeiso kulam misnahagim kamonu kimishpat harabanim. He and his family all follow the laws of the rabbis and our customs. Shomrim kol mitzvos, they keep all of the mitzvos. Vinizharim mikol masha asru zichronam levracha, and they abstain from anything that our sages have forbidden. ve'einam mapilim davar midivrehem zichronam levracha, and they don't even miss one single thing. These people were super, super frum. Gam holidu banim b'sochenu. They have also gave birth to children. It seems like it's specifically sons. Umalnu osam kibanenu, and they circumcised them like our children. Ubegadlam lamdu osam talmud Torah im banenu. They went to the same schools as our children. Behem hayom kamonu b'li hefresh klal, and they are like us without any distinction. Anachnu tamid korim lahem b'sefer Torah kehilchas govrin yudon. And we can't, and we give them alios in shul. Essentially, they are fully integrated into the Jewish community. Shuls, schools, Jewish communal life, they're part of us. V'hinei ata, godlu b'neihem. Now their sons have grown up. V'higiyu l'perek hanisuin, and they've reached marriageable age. U'mevakshim l'hinasei b'bnos Yisrael, and they want to marry the Jewish daughters in our community. V'nafshenu l'shol, and we're pining to ask. Higia im nuchal lases lahem mibnonasenu. Can we give them our daughters, v'nikach mibnosam, and can we marry their daughters? Now, this is what their question is. Uchidai hu haradvaz lismoch alav b'tshuvaso. Can we rely on the opinion of the Radvaz, who was an Egyptian rabbi, I believe in the 1500s, if I'm not mistaken. The early 1500s. So this is 300 years after that. So they ask, can we rely on the opinion of the Radvaz? The imyesh poskim acherim kisvaraso. And are there other Jewish authorities that hold like him? Ohu yachid ve'ein lismoch alav. Or is he a minority opinion, and are we not able to rely on him? So they're referencing this point of contention that the Radvaz had arguing with other rabbis, and they want to know, can we rely on this opinion? Now, before we see what the Radvaz's opinion is, let's see what the rabbis answered. So in source number 4, this is actually from the year 1914, over 60 years later. Not sure, I didn't have access to the original answer. They did receive an answer in the negative, and then they asked again in 1914. They didn't like the answer they got, so they asked again, and then they got the same answer. But in 1914, they got an answer back from Baghdad. This is what it says. Teshuvah, an answer. Hine din ze mefurash amur beves Yosef. This halacha, the answer to your question, is explicit in the Beis Yosef, which is essentially the forerunner to the Shulchan Aruch. So already in the 1400s, they claim, this question had been raised in a slightly different form, but this question had been raised and had been essentially decided without any point of contention. The Heviyu Ramah, and the Ramah, the Ashkenazi gloss to the Shulchan Aruch, brings it down. Hakaraim asur lehischatein bahem. Karaites. So Karaites were Jews that, like the Tzedukim earlier, that denied. Oh, sorry, I just got a comment on the chat. Why did they even need to ask if they could marry into the B'nai Israel if these people were deemed Jews? So we're about to explain that right now. They were aware of this concern that the Iraqi community believed. The Iraqi rabbis that we'll read now raised a concern about the Karaites and said that the B'nai Israel were similar to them. We'll see this in a minute. So the Karaites were a group of Jews, starting essentially from the Second Temple, that denied the validity of the oral law and essentially lived lives. They were Jewish, but they did not follow halacha at all, lived very different lives. And there's a community around to this day, actually, that of Karaites. So the Shulchan Aruch says that you are forbidden to marry Karaites. The kulam hem safik mamzerim, and all of them are potential mamzerim. A mamzer is the child of certain illegal marriage unions. Just as an example of what we're going to be talking about is if a woman is not divorced and has children with another man. So the children from that second union are called mamzerim, and they are not allowed to marry into the mainstream Jewish community. So the Shulchan Aruch says that Karaites are all potential mamzerim. The ein mekablim osam im rotzim lachzar, and we do not receive them if they want to rejoin the community. V'taima mefurash baposkim, and the reason for this is explicit. Why? Lefi shehem mekudashin nishoseyen bekesef o bebiya al pi haTorah. These Karaites marry their wives, where their marriage ceremonies use either money or something worth money, like a ring, like we do, o bebiya, or intimate or marital relations, as explicit in the Torah. So in terms of their marriage ceremony, they do follow what the halacha says, or what normative halacha says. Now, that is for the marriage part of it. However, for the divorce part, they don't. Umegarshin osan shelo kedas. But they do not divorce their wives according to halacha. Umishanim imatbeya shetavu chachamim. And they don't follow the same process that our sages have outlined. V'achar kach yinasu hanashim la'achirim b'chayei habalim. And now these divorced women will marry a new person while their original husband is still alive. V'nimtzu habanim mamzerim. And the children are mamzerim, may eshes ish, from an illegal marriage union. V'lachenim ratzu lachzar ein mekablim osam. And therefore, if they want to rejoin the Jewish community, we can't marry them. And then therefore, the Baghdadi sages says, V'lachen, elu b'nei Yisrael, these b'nei Israel, hanemtzaim ba'arei hodu, that are found in the Indian cities, din karoin isluhu. These Jews should have the same halacha, the same status as Karaites. V'asur lehischatein bahen. And it should be forbidden to marry them, mitam ha'asur shaharei gam hem mekadshim al pi haTorah, because their marriage ceremonies followed the halachic procedure. V'ein lehen gerishin. But they don't have the normative divorce procedure. V'kol ze pashut ubarur. And this is explicit and clear. So the concern that the Iraqi community in India and their rabbis had was that these Jews, these B'nai Israel Jews, had a halachic wedding ceremony, but did not have a halachic divorce ceremony. And for the past thousand of years, people were getting married and potentially getting divorced. And therefore, any of these people might be considered a mamzer and would be forbidden to marry into the mainstream Jewish community. And this concern was pretty much accepted. So I want to go back historically to trace the roots of this debate. As we see in source number 6, the original response of the Radvaz. So the Beis Yosef in source number 5, which the rabbis had quoted, says you can't marry a Karaite. The Iraqis in India said maybe we can rely on the Radvaz, who was lenient. So what did the Radvaz say? So the Radvaz lived in Egypt, where since the times of the Rambam, there was a huge Karaite community. And so it was not uncommon for a Karaite to become essentially a Baal Tshuva and want to return to the mainstream Jewish community. So the Radvaz in the 1500s was asked a question. Sha'alta mimeni be'echad mi ba'alei mikra. So I was asked regarding a person who, of the written Torah, a Karaite. Shekibel alav divrei chavros lihiyos ke'echad meharabanim. Essentially, he became a big Talmud Chacham and wanted to rejoin the Jewish community, v'lishmor kol mitzvos derabanan, and to follow all of the laws of our sages, v'lihizar mikol masha asru, and to refrain from anything they have forbidden. Im matur mutar lahasio isha, im yesh behem chashash pisul milavo bikahal olo. Are we allowed to marry him or not? Is this person a safek? Is he a potential mamzer or not? So he writes a very short response. He says, tshuva, the response. Kvar nishalti al ze pa mima acheros. I've been asked this many times beforehand. V'ha'alesi shehem mutarim. And I think that they are mutar. I think that they are permitted. lavo bekahal, to marry into the community, v'hatam. And the reason is, what is the rationale? We just learned before that people get married, but they get halachically married, but they did not have a halachic divorce procedure. So why is the Radvaz lenient? He says, shekol hakidushim shalahem heim be'edim psulim min haTorah. All of the witnesses for their marriage ceremonies are invalid, right? So all of these Karaites that were invited to this Karaite wedding, none of them believe in the divinity or the authority of the oral Torah. And they don't do any of the mitzvos in the oral Torah. And so because of that, they are invalid witnesses. In order to be a kosher Jewish witness, one of the prerequisites is to not deny and not keep a large portion of the Torah. So this is a very nuanced question and has a lot of important ramifications for nowadays, but pretty much everybody agreed that Karaites were considered invalid witnesses. So the Radvaz said, well, if they were invalid witnesses, then their kiddushin, then their marriage ceremonies were invalid, and so they were never married. And so if they were never married, they never needed to be divorced. And so therefore, if one of these women remarries, that's okay because she's not a married woman. Therefore, even though their divorce procedure is not a valid divorce procedure, there is no concern at all of mamzer shahare ein isha shalahem ishus, because their marriage ceremony is not a valid halachic marriage ceremony. So that was the reason for the Radvaz to be lenient. And so now we can understand what their question was. The Jews in India were asking, can we rely on this lenient opinion, even though the Shulchan Aruch said no? And the Iraqi community in Yerushalayim and in Baghdad said, no, you can't rely on this lenient opinion. Rather, you need to follow the stringent opinion of all of the other rabbis, and therefore they are not allowed to marry the B'nai Israel people. And now we're left with a question, which is, the Radvaz seems to have a good argument. If they're not kosher witnesses because they deny the validity of the oral Torah, somebody typed in, didn't Rav Moshe use a similar logic for some questionable marriages? Yes, Rav Moshe Feinstein did make this argument. I hope to touch on it a little bit more in this next piece from Rabbi Herzog. Each case, is, especially in modern times, is very, very nuanced. But yes, this argument was raised. Again, how it translates into modern times in terms of non-Orthodox communities is a much more nuanced discussion, as we'll see. So if you look in source number 7, this is a response from Rabbi Herzog, the first chief rabbi of the state of Israel. The first Ashkenazi chief rabbi was Rav Kook, but the chief rabbi during the founding of the state of Israel was Rav Herzog. And after the founding of the state of Israel, many of these B'nai Israel people moved to Israel. And this reignited the whole question again. And it was a huge, huge halachic debate, now became an international issue. And there were two chief rabbis at the time. The Sephardic chief rabbi was Rev Uziel, and the Ashkenazi rabbi was Rev Herzog. So Rev Uziel was known to be very lenient about Jewish status, conversions, and so he held that they were permitted. Most of the other rabbis in that time period, especially the Haredi rabbis, were not happy about it, and Rav Herzog was sort of on the fence at the beginning. So this is the first part of a response that he gave, just to sort of explain how the authorities that don't agree with the Radvaz's argument that their wedding ceremonies were invalid, how do those people that still prohibit marrying the B'nai Israel, how did they respond to the Radvaz? So he explains in the first box in source number 7, Kigon Keneged Yisod Zeh, in response to this principle of the Radvaz, Heshivu Ha'osrim, those that prohibit have responded, the only time we said that a person who denies the validity of the oral law is considered an invalid witness, that is only by the first generation of Karaites who rebelled against Torah Shebaal Peh. This requires a bit of explanation. The reason why somebody that doesn't that denies the validity of Torah and mitzvos or doesn't keep Torah and mitzvos is not considered a valid witness is not just because they don't keep mitzvos. Rather, the term that you have to be is a mumar lahachis, somebody that rebels not because they're pulled by, they have a desire to do a sin, but rather because they want to essentially anger God. They want to rebel against Judaism. And so anybody that rebels against the entire corpus of Jewish law or a significant corpus of Jewish law by saying, we're going to deny the validity of the oral Torah because we just don't believe in it, that constitutes rebellion. So Rav Herzog says, but that was only true by the first generation of people that actively rebelled against something that they knew about. Aval hadoros she'achareihem, but subsequent generations, einam psulei edus, they are not invalid for witnesses, mipnei she'anusim hem, because they were forced. They grew up in a system where they didn't know any better. D'minhag avoseihem biyadeihem, they just followed whatever they were taught. V'chashivi kitino kanishba bein ha'akum. And they're considered like children captured by idol worshippers that essentially grew up in a non-Jewish society. So by and large, especially in the olden days where there was no access to the outside information, if a Jewish child was captured by non-Jews, raised as a non-Jew in a non-Jewish town, they obviously weren't keeping Torah and mitzvos. But that doesn't mean that they were invalid witnesses. That doesn't mean that they're going to be punished in the next world, because they didn't have any choice in that matter. They don't know any better. And so therefore, they are still considered valid witnesses because they're not rebelling against Judaism. And so therefore, Rav Herzog says the same thing is true here. Even though these Karaites don't keep normative halacha and they deny the validity of normative halacha, they're still not rebelling against Judaism because they don't know any better. So therefore, and if you look in the parentheses, Rav Herzog says, "Uchehad da amrinan de einam nechshavim lemumar mishum chilul Shabbos befarhesya." So the Karaites don't keep Shabbos the way we do, but nevertheless, that doesn't make them rebellious. Umikevan sheinam psulei edus, and because they are not considered invalid witnesses, dinechshavim lishogegim, because they're considered to be inadvertent transgressors, harei kidushehem kidushin. Therefore, they're valid witnesses, so their marriage ceremonies are valid. And because they don't have a valid divorce procedure, then now all of their children are considered potential mamzerim. So this argument, it's a very lenient argument in terms of human psychology that we're not going to fault somebody for doing something that they didn't know any better about. That's not considered rebellion. But one of the sort of cons of this argument, or one of the consequences of this argument, is that they're considered valid witnesses, so that brings up the whole Mamzerus issue. Another one to sort of advance this argument was the Chazon Ish, also who lived during this time of the founding of the State of Israel. This was a very, very pressing issue in terms of who was defined as a mumar, because at that point, a significant percentage of the Israeli population was secular. And there were multiple generations of secular Jews, many of them who were really did not like religious Jews and Judaism in general. Many of them were anti-religious, and many of the state policies at the outset were anti-religious. And so we needed to define who was considered a mumar, who was considered essentially a rebel against Judaism. There were many, many halachic ramifications in terms of personal status, in terms of witnesses for marriage, divorce, kashrus. There are a myriad of ramifications for this. And the Chazon Ish famously ruled, which to my knowledge has been accepted by the vast majority of poskim and Jewish halachic authorities throughout the spectrum, that we only consider somebody a rebel if they actively broke away from their tradition out of hatred to Judaism. But people that grew up in a secular society are not considered rebels because they don't know any better. So again, while on the whole, this might be a very positive or at least a understanding halachic status, it nevertheless resurfaced all of the potential concerns about Karaites, and what was more pressing were the B'nai Israel people. Because if their marriage ceremonies were valid, then they might be mamzerim. And Rav Herzog was actually quite concerned about this at the beginning. But after a few years, I believe in the 1950s, I think like 54 or 55, he eventually changed his mind and he was lenient. And he allowed the B'nai Israel people to marry into the mainstream Jewish community. So let's see what he argued to permit it. So in the second box, he has a technical argument. He says, "Kvar orer hanoda b'Yehuda zatzal." So the Noda b'Yehuda, Rav Yecheskel Landau, the rabbi in Prague in the 1600s, he says, again, I don't really know why, but apparently there was a Karaite that moved to Central Europe, Central Eastern Europe. I haven't been able to track down the exact town. It was an unusual occurrence, and that way I was essentially forwarded to the greatest rabbi of that age. But he said that I've already commented that the Karaim, that with regards to Karaites, Sha'af HaRama, that even the Rama who said that they can't marry into the community, Lo hichmir ella ba'asroi dekvi'i. He said, the Rama only said that it's prohibited, that we're only concerned about a mamzer in a place where there is a Karaite community, where that person is from. But if the person moves to a different community, then we're not concerned. This is a very technical argument, and it's really not within the scope of this year to do it real justice. Hopefully we'll learn about it a little bit more next week. But there's a concept in halacha called rov, called majority, that we follow the majority. Now, if there's a majority of something, generally halacha says that if we're not sure about the status of something, we follow the majority. So if you find a piece of meat on a block where there are 9 kosher butchers and 1 treif butcher, and there's no identifying sign on the meat, because there are more kosher butchers than non-kosher butchers, we can assume that this piece of meat came from the kosher store. However, that's only if it's in that block, if that piece of meat was found on that block. But let's say you found it in a different part of town, then we might not follow that. So the Noda b'Yehuda says that we would only be concerned by this person who we don't know if he is a mamzer, only in a place if he's sort of found in the city where he's from. But since he moved to a different community, now halacha views it differently, where it's a sort of a 50-50. It's not a majority saying that he is a mamzer and a minority probability that he isn't. Now it's equal probability, so we can be lenient. So therefore, Rav Herzog argues the same thing should be true by the B'nai Israel. These B'nai Israel people moved from their original location in India. They moved to Calcutta. They moved to Israel. They moved to different places. And so now, since it is only a suffix, since it is only a potential concern, we should be lenient. So that's his sort of technical argument. But there's a much more, not philosophical, but there's a much broader sort of argument that he asserts. And that is, v'af shechach me ge'one hasfardim b'Yerushalayim ir ha-kodesh b'doros ha'achronim nimru v'gamru le'asar. So even though the Sephardic scholars, both in Baghdad and in Yerushalayim, prohibited it, b'chol zos minei safek plugta lo nafka she'elezu. Just because these Sephardic Iraqi rabbis said that we have to follow the more stringent opinion, it doesn't remove the question. Essentially, what he's saying is that this question has been going on for many generations, starting from the time of the Radvaz in the 1500s. The Radvaz had been lenient, many argued, but it went back and forth, and there was never a clear consensus. And so he says, just because these people, as great Talmidei Chachamim as they were, just because these great Sephardic rabbis decided to be stringent, we don't have to follow that. They could decide for themselves, but me, as the chief rabbi of Israel, I am not forced to follow their opinion because there was never a halachic consensus on the matter. And so therefore, he says, you can be lenient. If you look on towards the end of the second box where I bolded, the second bolded part, he says, there are actually two sfeikos. There are two sort of questions here. Safek bedin, there's the safek of whether the halacha follows the Radvaz or not. And second of all, safek b'ma'aseh, there's also essentially a historical safek, a historical question whether these people were actually mamzerim or not. So he says, because it is a safek sfeika, there are two questions, one about what the halacha is and two, what historically happened, we can be lenient. So far, Rav Herzog gave two arguments. One was a technical halachic reason. The second was a broader sort of jurisprudence argument that just because one body of or one demographic group of Jewish rabbis decided something doesn't mean that there's unanimous halachic consensus, so I can say what I believe is right. And then the third, which what we'll see now, is historical testimony given by the elders of the B'nai Israel community to the Tel Aviv based in 1962. So if you can see on source number 8, there's a picture of the person who I think if I did my research correctly, his name was Menachem Shimon Kolet. So he was born in the 1930s in India, and he moved to Israel with the rest of his community. And he was essentially considered the leading authority. He wasn't a rabbi or a Torah scholar, but in terms of the history and culture of his people, he's one of the oldest people in the community, and he's one of sort of the most recognized authorities on the B'nai Israel customs. And back even then, when he was in his 30s, he was still an important person even then. And he testified at the Beis Din about the culture of his community. And this was really a turning point in the debate. If you look in the top of source number 8, we have a transcript of his testimony, or part of his testimony. He says, "Haya minhag shelo hischatnu im grusha. It is the custom to not marry a divorcee, ki anu sanu es hagerishin, because we strongly disapprove of the divorce procedure. Hagerishin shesudaru al yidei ziknei hakehila. There was a divorce procedure that was set up by the elders of the community. Hayalahen tokef, and it carried weight. Aval zehaya mikre nadir me'od. It was a very rare phenomenon." And so what this person, what Menachem Shimon Kolet testified, was that divorce was almost non-existent in the B'nai Israel community, going back from time immemorial. And so therefore, Rav Herzog said, if our only concern is that these people are potential mamzerim due to a remarried divorcee who wasn't really halachically divorced, according to this testimony, there's absolutely no concern. There might be a very, very rare phenomenon, but that does not have halachic weight. Therefore, Rav Herzog argued, there's absolutely no concern with the status of these people, and therefore the B'nai Israel can marry into the mainstream Jewish community. Now, up until that point, aside from a few exceptions, most rabbis forbid the B'nai Israel from marrying into the mainstream Jewish community. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Avadya Yosef was not happy about it, Rav Moshe Sternbach was not happy about it. Most of rabbis, especially the Haredi rabbis, were not accepting of the B'nai Israel. After this tshuva was published, now both chief rabbis agreed that the B'nai Israel were allowed to marry into the mainstream Jewish community, and that's how the Rabbanut was instructed to proceed. So now with the official Israeli rabbinate recognizing these people, I would say 99% of all the other rabbis in the international community accepted their decision, which I don't think always has happened historically. But this time around, to my knowledge, 99% of the international Jewish community accepts the B'nai Israel people as Jews. And not only that, but you are allowed to marry a member of the B'nai Israel community. And that's how it is to this day. There are one or two very, very small groups of people that don't. But pretty much everybody agrees that these people are halachically Jewish and allowed to marry anybody they want. If you just see the cover of his new book that came out a couple of years ago, so Shimon Menachem Kolet says that he's often called upon to give talks. And if you look at the bolded part, he says every research paper should have a bibliography at the end of the thesis. But since I am writing what was told to me by my elders, as well as my own recollections, I have no bibliography to present. Now, that is something very, very interesting. Now, I'm not a trial lawyer, but testimony, you know, there are different levels of evidence. And especially in the academic community, you need to back up what you say with sources. This person says, I have no written sources. I have no verifiable proof. The only authority that I'm essentially relying upon is what I heard and what I'm saying. And this was one person that nevertheless, Rav Herzog accepted. Rav Herzog accepted this testimony, and essentially the entire world accepted that testimony and now regards them as completely halachically Jewish and permitted to marry. I want to close with one last point. Because up until now, what we've been saying is that the only concern that these people had, the only concern that the Jewish community had regarding the B'nai Israel was whether they were potential mamzerim, whether they were the product of an illegal marriage union. No one ever doubted that they were Jewish, however. Or to be more accurate, nobody doubted it until the 1950s when they moved to Israel. And one rabbi, I believe it was Rav Moshe Sternbach, called it into question and asked, well, how do we know that they were Jewish? We don't know. We found these people in a very isolated community. They might be following Torah and mitzvos, but how do we know that they're Jewish? And Rav Herzog responds in source number 9, and he says, these are obviously Jews. How do we know that? Because everybody says that they're Jewish. He says, V'tamachti yisodosai, I have supported my position, al teshuvos, on various responsa, v'igeres harambam, and the letter of the Rambam that we saw earlier. He doesn't have any proof. All he says is that Jews, for the last 1,000 years, have been calling these people Jews. And that's enough. And as we'll see hopefully next week, Birur Yahadut, which is the term, the halachic term for determining whether somebody is Jewish or not, is a very amorphous topic. There really isn't that much halacha in the Gemara that deals with it, just because it wasn't a very relevant question. And the halacha nowadays, there's really no strict procedure that is explicit in halacha, but rather it's sort of the accumulation of evidence, whether it supports that a certain person is Jewish or not. Attempts have been made to formalize it, but it's really not a uniform system. And what Rav Herzog was saying is that, yeah, we don't have any proof that they were Jewish, but everybody's been saying they were Jewish up until this point, so we shouldn't doubt that. And that's pretty much been the party line of everybody, of all other rabbanim, even the ones that says that we can't marry them. Nobody was saying that they weren't Jewish. Recently, though, there has been a phenomenon of mitochondrial genetic testing. As we know, cells carry a person's DNA, sort of the instruction manual that tells cells what to do and makes the body look the way it is. And that's inherited from both parents, from the mother and the father. There's a certain part of the cell called the mitochondria. This is a subcellular particle that, or a subcellular organelle, that's the scientific term, that essentially produces energy for the cell to carry out its basic functions. And that has its own DNA, which is only passed down from the mother. Now, it took a while for the scientific community to develop the technology to study mitochondrial DNA. We've been studying regular DNA for a couple of decades now, but it's only been in the last, I don't know, I would say 20 years, that we've been able to study mitochondrial DNA, which is only passed down from the mother. And so therefore, because Jewish personal status is determined by the mother, a lot of Jewish doctors and scientists and rabbanim have been debating, are we able to determine personal status? Is this person Jewish based off of mitochondrial DNA? Now, there are a lot of different levels to this question, meaning you can go one generation up, or in the case of the B'nai Israel, 10, 20, 30 generations up. And the degree of certainty that you have is much less the further up the chain historically you go along. So in source number 10 and 11, I copied an abstract and then a news article summarizing the findings of a genetic study. It was published in March 2016. It was a joint study for people from Einstein Medical School, Tel Aviv Medical School, Cornell, a bunch of other schools, that they did genetic mitochondrial research on the B'nai Israel people. And in short, what they found was that these people were Jewish, but on the male side. As you see in the bottom of the extract, of the abstract, it involved Middle Eastern Jews and was sex biased, with more male Jewish and local female contribution. What that means is that the evidence from the DNA suggests that there were Jewish men that married local Indian women. Now, if we go back to sort of the B'nai Israel's origin story, they claim that there were seven Kohanim, seven men, as well as seven women. Now, we don't know if that's accurate or not. This evidence doesn't tell us if there were significant Jewish women. It just says that there was a significant Indian, native Indian Jewish women population. And if you look in the news article, in the bolded part, it said that it was accomplished mainly by men and married local women, possibly after their conversion, although genetics obviously does not provide an answer to that, whether the women converted before marrying into the B'nai Israel community. Once they established the community, the B'nai Israel preserved their unique genetic character, married only within the community, and refrained from integrating with other non-Jewish Indian groups. So I'll leave you to read the rest of the news article on your own. Essentially, the rest of it is basically saying we don't know for sure, the tests are inconclusive, there are a lot of potential confounding factors. So this test is not can't really be relied upon to make any significant decisions, just because it goes so far up the chain that there could be a lot of other causes that we don't understand yet. But what this does show is that the B'nai Israel did not intermarry once the community was established. And that supports their assertion. They only married within their community. They only married other B'nai Israel people. And so the only concern that we might have is the initial wave, contrary to their origin story, where they had seven men and seven women. Here it suggests that there were local women that sort of married in. Now, is that a concern? Maybe these women didn't convert, and so maybe all the subsequent generations are not Jewish. So to my knowledge, nobody has really talked about this on a halachic level. It could just be because, as we said, the evidence really isn't so strong yet. Another possible answer could be that even if they didn't do a formal conversion, meaning maybe they did do a conversion, we don't know, but even if they didn't do a conversion like what we do, it still might be enough. Because as we'll see, a conversion is sort of three parts. You have to do a procedure. You have to, if you're a male, you have to have a bris milah, which they did. Whether you're a male or a female, you need to go to a mikvah, which I don't know if they did that or not. But then the more substantive part is that you need to have two kabbalos, two acceptances. One is to accept all of the Torah and mitzvos. The second acceptance is to be part of the Jewish people. So these B'nai Israel obviously accepted upon themselves to be part of the Jewish people. They've been asserting that from the very beginning. The mitzvah part, they didn't have any other mitzvahs. The only mitzvahs that they had were Shabbos and Bris Milah, which they kept. And so even though they didn't really keep all of the rest of the mitzvahs, and they didn't initially accept upon themselves all of the rest of the mitzvahs, They did keep what they had, and when they learned more, they followed it. So the argument could be made that even though they married non-Jewish women and they didn't have a conversion process like what we do, they would still nevertheless be halachically Jewish. That's where I want to leave you all. It is a happy ending in the sense that the B'nai Israel are part now of the Jewish community. What I want to discuss next week is mitochondrial DNA in halacha. This was a much more historical use, trying to figure out sort of 2,000 years ago what happened. A much more pressing debate now is the use of mitochondrial DNA in terms of personal status of somebody who's Jewish, perhaps one or two generations up. We'll talk about a case from Australia and Sweden next week. Can we use mitochondrial DNA to determine whether a person is halachically Jewish? But in honor of Yom Ha'atzmaut, I want to close with one observation. And that is, we spoke at the very beginning that the Torah gave the Jewish people the opportunity to become a Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, both a kingdom of priests, a polity of Kohanim, as well as a Goy Kadosh, a holy national culture, a national ethos, a national identity. And both of them were made possible by the Torah and becoming the Jewish people. And if we look at what happened by Rav Herzog, it was something fascinating. You had this marginalized Jewish community that, not through caprice or malice, but because of very legitimate halachic concern, was essentially restricted from integrating with the rest of the Jewish community. And amidst significant opposition, Rav Herzog, by virtue, partially by virtue of his stature as a Talmud Chacham, but also, in my opinion, by virtue of the fact that he was the chief rabbi of Israel and essentially in charge of personal status, he was able to change all of that, and most people accepted it simply because he says this is the halacha and he provided cogent arguments. And that would not have been possible had the state of Israel not existed. And so the halachic social and cultural development that was made possible by having a Jewish polity, by having a Mamleches Kohanim, or the forerunner to a Mamleches Kohanim, having a Jewish polity, having a Jewish culture, that was what the state of Israel gives us a foretaste of what is possible when Mashiach comes. And so we have to be thankful for the miracle of the state of Israel for many, many reasons. We have to thank Hashem for the incredible gift that we have, and we should never take it for granted. There are so many reasons for that. But one which I don't think is often overlooked, but just is often not appreciated as much as the others, is that it gives us the opportunity to develop a Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, to develop a Jewish polity and a Jewish national identity and culture that can foster revolutionary halachic development. I don't mean that in the sense of just changing halacha, but the halachic discourse can grow and change in such unprecedented ways because all of the Jewish people are unified in one place and with one ideal. And again, just as we merited to see miracles 72 years ago, we should all merit to see miracles nowadays. We should all be healthy, and we should all see each other in person in the state of in Israel with the coming of Mashiach very, very soon. I look forward to learning with you next week. I want to continue talking about mitochondrial DNA. I'm going to try, I have to figure out how to do this. Let me try to unmute in case people have questions. Hold on, let me just figure out how to do this. Meeting controls and unmute all. Okay, so if anybody has questions, please feel free to ask. Okay, so God willing, I look forward to learning with you all next week. I will see you all at 12 p.m.
Oh, wait, I ask a question?
Oh, yes, sure.
Ethiopian Jews, I was around when there was that question, and I happened to have known one, and he was a very, very nice guy, went to YU. And I don't know if you're going to talk about it in the future or not, but how do they compare, contrast, or just a quick thought you have on that situation.
So I'm not an expert on Ethiopian Jews. I can only tell you what I know just from a cursory understanding of the topic. So if anybody has any more details, please feel free to share. To my knowledge, the Ethiopian Jewish community is accepted by and large. They're definitely accepted by the Rabbanut, by the Israeli rabbinate, due to strong assertions by Rav Avadya Yosef. It's a whole nother topic unto itself about Rav Avadya lobbying on behalf of these old Ethiopian Jews and championing their cause. He was very instrumental in gaining the acceptance that they did. There are still some groups that are concerned about the status of these of Jews from Ethiopia and do require what is called Giyur Luchumra, which is that you need to convert, not because we don't think you're Jewish, but because we're not sure if the person is Jewish. Ethiopian Jews obviously take great umbrage at that and are very offended by that. It really goes both ways. The official party line of the Israeli rabbinate is that they are Jews. There are some Jewish communities, though, that are more hesitant to have them fully integrated in terms of marriage. But again, this is just a cursory knowledge. I don't know so much about the topic. When I went to Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, there were many.
So on a case by case basis.
Uh huh.
But I remember a shul that has some Ethiopians, most are accepted, some of them not been, and have been meeting with the Ethiopian rabbi in Israel back and forth to try to figure out how to finish the gerus.
Ah, interesting. Okay.
Thank you very much, Tzvi. Very interesting.
Thank you so much. Wonderful learning.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was great. Bye.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. I think he was excellent. He was so good. Yeah.